This podcast is brought to you by Ramsden Recruitment. It's episode 15 of Chefs on the Pass, the Craft Guild of Chefs official podcast. Let's go! And today I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by the legendary Daniel Galmish, a chef whose career has taken him from his early days in France to Michelin stars across Scotland, Bristol and beyond, as well as stints in Singapore, Portugal and at some of the UK's most iconic kitchens. We chat about his love of nature and produce, what it really takes to achieve consistency at the highest level, and why you should never cook for the star, only for your guests. Daniel's a true icon of the industry, and I can promise you he drops pure inspiration throughout this conversation. So make sure you hit that subscribe button and come right on in. Hello and welcome to Chefs on the Pass, the Craft Guild of Chefs official podcast, hosted as ever by me, Phil Street. Now then, I am delighted to welcome today's guest to the show, someone who's been at the forefront of the UK culinary scene for a very, very long time. Sorry, maybe not a very, very long time. That's maybe unfair, Daniel. But it always gives me huge pleasure to spend time with this chap. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome Daniel Galmish to the show.
Hello, Phil. Good afternoon. How are you?
I am super well. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for having me today. It's a pleasure. And as you say, yes, we keep crossing each other paths, and then every 1 year or 2 years or something. And it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Indeed. Well, we'll totally talk about this as well as we get into it. But one of the things that I've always loved about you is your ability to stay at the forefront. Like you've been at the cutting edge of the UK food scene for quite a long time now, but also you've always got a smile on your face. It's like you are definitely doing what you are supposed to be doing.
Yes, I think for that, there is no doubt. I think I said that quite often. I would restart all over again, that's for sure.
Really?
And yes, I love this trade. I think not only is it a great opportunity for meeting loads of people, for creating a really good global friendship worldwide, as we do travel as well by doing demo or guest chef or et cetera, et cetera. Happy because I deal with food, and food equal nature, nature equal sustainability, and you realize how our planet is gorgeous and can produce and help us and do so many things. So yes, I would say.
Yeah, if only more people thought like that, eh?
It would be lovely, yes.
Yeah.
So I was brought up like that, you know, and that's a difference. My great aunt used to have a small holding, and it was not a commercial, it was for friend and family. And from a young age, we were really involved with nature. We also knew that all the animals we were feeding by hand generally at that time, and helping with some of the labor, and after that, go in the kitchen and cook with my great aunt. You knew somehow they were going to be in a pot one day. So we made sure that they were happy animals first, so we can be happy eaters.
Was that your route into becoming a chef then, do you think? Did that have a big bearing?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And also because my dad and my mom was a gourmand, and my mom was a very good cook. And she was taught by my great aunt, which was my dad. Aunt. So I think, yes, and we all love food. My father used to hunt. We had a big garden, and we used to go and collect vegetables in the garden and help to turn the earth once a year to be able to plant everything. So we were involved with that, and I always loved it. I love nature. That's why I live in the middle of nowhere. I mean, when I say nowhere, you can see nowhere.
Very nice. And yeah, for those who are only listening to this, Daniel's just shown me out of his window, and yes, nothing but greenery.
Yeah, it's a valley. It's a Chiltern Hills and valleys. And I like the quietness, but I like nature. Without it, what would we do?
Well, indeed. Indeed. You know. And there's the argument again, right? You're just making the same argument again, which is incredible, which is, we all know this. Why are we not working harder to be better at it? But anyway,
I know it's a puzzle to me sometimes, and I know more people are doing it. I know there's much more interest, especially since COVID, because people realize that without just say the farmers straight away, simply we wouldn't, you know, be where we are and eat and do what we're doing. And thank you guys.
Yeah, for sure. And a big shout out to Clarkson's Farm, by the way, as a massive farm convertee on the back of that, because he's done a very clever thing, which is make farming entertaining, but actually it's also educational. I think the vast majority of people are learning about the plight that these guys who are working their backsides off day in, day out to bring food to our table.
I can see them in the valley there. They just all cut the barley and everything. They're growing the corn at the moment. They're doing, and they are up with the first sunlight and they are in bed with the last sunlight.
Yeah.
I mean, and you realize they work. I mean, wow.
Yeah. No, indeed. So another reason why you became a chef instead of a farmer then, right, is because you wanted an easier life.
No, because I'm a gourmand. I love food. But also, you know, I'm even at home. I cook a lot at home. You may have seen a social media platform. We with my partner, Elise, we're doing a lot of things at the moment, trying to set different kind of short reel video where there is movement in it and we bring things alive out of a photo and this kind of stuff to make realize people what it was before, where we're going, where we are now. So we're doing a lot of things and we're talking about a lot of produce and supporting people and trying to pass on always the message, you know. And I think it's important.
For sure. Yeah. So tell us then how your career took off as a chef and you know, you had an early interest in food. How did that transition into actually becoming your profession?
Well, yes, I had, like I said earlier, a lot of interest in food. And also my parents were gourmands, but my mom used to cook and we used to invite our family. And always I was always in it. And I was good at studying. It's not the point. Like sometimes people think you're in a trade of what we're doing, a waiter or a chef, because you failed at school. It's absolutely so much rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because your interest is elsewhere. You know, how many people have quit university and became what they became?
Well, indeed. Yeah. No, I completely agree. I was only talking about this the other day with my wife when we were out on our dog walk out in nature. And we were talking about the fact that of all of my university mates, I think of which there was probably a circle of about 12 of us that were really tight. Only two of them went on to do something that was related to the actual degree.
So therefore, by a little bit of contact with my father's twin brother, and he just knew an hotelier, a restaurateur, not far away, from Franche-Comté, which is the beautiful kind of county, Bourgogne-Franche-Comté, sorry, and a beautiful county along the Swiss border, which is in between the Vosges Mountain, Alsace, and the Jura, which is a beautiful area. And my father's brother just knew an hotelier, and I started my apprenticeship 3 years in a beautiful place in Luxeuil-les-Bains, which is a spa town, a full apprenticeship 3 years. And we had a tiny small holding within the restaurant, which was mainly poultry. So that gave me back a little bit what I have with my great aunt, and I felt very comfortable. It was hard, obviously. Of course, we knew that. But I feel that I had a very complete apprenticeship in the sense, and I had time to do all the section and learn about everything, and went on stage in Brittany from there to learn about fish and shellfish and all that. And after that, from there, that's where I am now. I carry on, and came in London at the Gavroche. I was 19 years of age. I mean, it was very scary.
Yeah, no doubt. A total change, like an uproot of your life, really. As everything that was familiar to you, gone forever.
Yeah, but I loved it. I mean, the Roux brothers, I mean, all the team in the kitchen was mostly French. But I learned so much from Albert and Michel Roux Senior. I mean, it was amazing. Amazing experience. And I was very lucky to be able to go to the Gavroche. And since then, and from my apprenticeship too, I work only in Michelin Star and Relais Chateau and Boutique Hotel all my life. Mainly, except once in Méridien Penina in Algarve, where I ran 8 outlets, and it was a new game for me, new environment, big operation. Wow.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, isn't it? And we were, even before we switched the microphone on, we were talking about you did a stint with Aston Martin Racing. It's kind of like that in itself, and we'll go into your career in a bit more depth in a second, but you know, you've already just highlighted the diversity of opportunity available as a chef, like, you know, in terms of the type of businesses that you can actually be attached to. Le Gavroche is obviously one of the most famous restaurants ever, probably in the world. The Roux brothers are responsible for so many amazing chefs. And also probably responsible for completely changing the direction of travel for cuisine in this country. I think.
Yes, I think what was very interesting, the government obviously is very French, of course, we know that. But I think that's the way they helped to transform the British scene of cooking, the awareness. And one thing over the years, which I noticed, and I've been in UK for now 39 years, which I didn't know, I didn't think I was going to be, actually.
Yeah, when you arrived here as a 19-year-old.
But I didn't realize at that time when I was in the Gavroche, although all produce from the Gavroche, or not all, but a part of them was British, the rest was all French, because at the time, they imported things they saw they couldn't find in UK. But since then, I kind of look at it and I say, my God, the produce they've got in here is unbelievable. And you feel that sometime in the past, they didn't realize how much abundant, great produce they had all over. In Scotland, we know that. I'm a fan of Scotland. It's my second country. I live there. I had my first Michelin star in Nottingham, in Port Patrick. Really, really, at that time, the amount of great produce there were. And I guess for me, a little bit more in Scotland than is in England. I mean, so many great produce, which now we know and people realize, and people are starting to buy only British, of course. Why not? Amazing, really.
Yeah. So how did Le Gavroche come about? As a 19-year-old, did you have the aspiration that you wanted to come to the UK for any particular reason?
I applied just after my apprenticeship, I wanted to go to work in different 2 and 3 star in France. And at that time, I had a good commis with the backup of my boss, who was the next Ferdinand Point, La Pyramide in Vienne, the 3 Michelin star. He used to be a sous chef there. He said, okay, now you should write letter, because at the time, you just write letter to restaurateurs, Alain Chapelle and all these people at the time. And I write. I also wrote in a Gavroche, and it's happened. And they were looking for stuff in a Gavroche, and I decided to apply, and that's where it started. So it was, I came in a Gavroche, it was 1977, and stayed in 1977-78, and it was a jubilee. I mean, I never seen a carros with the Queen at that time going across, and said, what the heck's going on? Because in France, we don't have that, right? As you know.
Yeah,
I don't have royalty, but also it was fascinating, and the Gavroche was busy, hard work. I mean, hard work. But we used to play hard too, because we finished late. It was no service for lunch, but we used to do 2 service for dinner. And after that, we cleaned the kitchen. It was maybe 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning. And we used to go in Soho and just enjoy a Chinese food, or to go in a discotheque and back home at 5 o'clock. And all. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Oh, God. Can you imagine doing that now?
No, probably not. But I learned so much. They were very strict, but I learned so much. I mean, for me, with my apprenticeship and a couple of other people, my best experience, definitely.
Right.
Loved the Gavroche. And actually, Sylvie Nogiardin was already there.
Right.
Already, he was the head maitre d' at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, and now you see him and we meet each other sometimes, say, wow, a long time. Yeah.
But there again, that's another beautiful part of this industry, right? Is that, like, the people, and you highlight the fact that you worked hard, you play hard. Generally, when you're doing that with people, you can't help but build bonds with people, right?
Yes.
Like, that last a lifetime. They don't last fleetingly. You can pick up the phone to these people, probably. And, you know, and that's something which I think is really, really unique to hospitality. I think one for the reason is that I think the vast majority of people who are passionate about hospitality and this as a career generally are people as well.
Yes.
You know, they enjoy being around people.
Yeah. And I think there's most of the friends I still have in the trade are from the past.
Yeah.
A lot of them. And if you see people you train became your friend, part of your family, but yes, I mean, wow.
Yeah.
It's like Raymond Blanc, we know each other for 28 years, Esther Blumenthal, or this guy. I mean, it's good.
Cool. Yeah, great. It's nice. Great. Yeah. I know who to come to then when I'm organising a party. That's So from Le Gavroche, how did it progress from there?
Well, what I learned in Le Gavroche was massive and very interesting. And after that, I returned to France and I went back to where I was an apprentice to put a little bit in practice. So I came back as a sous chef, I remember. And I put in practice what I learned with the Gavroche and tried to change a few things along with the boss. Obviously, he was still there running the place with his son. And so put that in. And after that, I move again and apply to go to other two or three stars in France. And with my experience of the Gavroche, it was much easier because you go up the scale. At the time, people recommend you. So you send a letter, but you can say Alain Chapelle would say, hello, Michel Roud, how is Daniel? He just applied for here. How was he with you? Is he on time? Is he working hard? Is he a good chef? Is he a nice guy? Blah, blah, blah. And everything used to go from word of mouth, almost on the top of your letter. And so I was really looking forward to go to Alain Chapelle because I love his style. I've heard what he was doing and I always look. I didn't get any letter back because sometimes you don't, sometimes they didn't even bother. So I went to a beautiful restaurant in Colmar in France, Alsace, who call Restaurant Schillinger, which I really, really loved. I learned so much there. I was one of his head chef or executive chef, you would say nowadays, was an ex-executive chef of Paul Bocuse. And I learned all about sauces. I stayed there nearly 1 year and I learned everything about sauce. That's all I've done for nearly 1 year. But the classic way of everything. And if it wasn't good, we restart. And not good, it is start, et cetera, et cetera. And that tool and that year have served me all my life because sauces, jus, dressing, all that in the industry, it's so important. And so many people don't do it right because you need to really put a lot of attention, a lot of patience and learn all of it. And when I say all of it, it's from a stock to the jus, to the dressing, to a sauce, to crustacea and meat and veal and this and et cetera. I mean, the whole package. It was amazing. And I think that has helped me a lot in my career to not only get a reward or award and et cetera, but to get all these rosettes and Michelin star and everything. That was some I think, of the point who have helped me so much.
Yeah.
On the top of the rest and on the top of the team who work with you, we should never forget that it's not only a man who gets a Michelin star, it's a team. Yeah. Without your team, you are zero. You get nothing. So it's a shame that the team is never quite recognized and don't get a mini star, you know, or something. A mini trophy. And say, hey, guys.
Well, you heard it here first. If you're listening, Michelin, you know, come on. Let's have a team Michelin star award.
No, but you know what I mean. Too many prima donna chef things. It's me. I said, excuse me, you're never in your kitchen already, so just be happy that you get a Michelin star this year because your team has done all your work. Do you know what I mean? No name to be mentioned is not the point, but it is quite often, and I don't find that very, very nice not to recognize how much people are working behind the scene.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was amazing. Amazing experience. And after that, I went from this gentleman in Alsace, Jean Schillinger. I went to work for Marc Menaud. That was another experience. Wow, it was tough. It's three Michelin star. I was on a fish section.
The way that you said that was an experience.
There's
definitely, yes, there's story. There's bound to be stories in there around.
So it was hardcore. Yeah. But same.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So, but here's the thing, right? I mean, yes, like I think we've come a long way from, you know, bullying environments and things like that. And I think we absolutely need to draw a line between understanding what is a tough environment, which is sometimes for your benefit.
Definitely.
You know, I think we need to rebrand what tough actually means. To you know, when you take it too far into bullying, that is without question, that's too far. But in actual fact, you could probably recount anybody that's been even remotely successful in their life, in whatever they choose to do, has had tough moments. That's my rant over.
I agree with you. A tough time mean tough because there's a standard, there's a demand, there's a kind of. You're only as good as your last service. So that means this is the team altogether. You have to produce for customers who are really, really looking forward to the meal. Also, we should not forget that some people never been in that kind of environment. So sometimes a lady or a gent is invited in a two-star. There is a lot of pressure on them. Or what should I wear? What do I expect? How do I have to be at the table? Blah, blah, blah. But on the other side, the tough part for the chef is to be able to deliver. And obviously, when you take a name, any kind of name, who run this place and own this place, he expects a lot from his team. And so that's normal. So yeah. Tough in the sense, and okay, guys, are we ready for the service? And I was mentioning Mark Menaud just a couple of seconds ago, and that was the case with Mark Menaud. He used to have a microphone in the kitchen. The service was coming. They, I mean, they are 3-star. It's massive, you know, the work they have to do to reach that level, and they want to keep it. And he was on his microphone service and doing a bit of joke all the time because I was Mark Menaud. He used to love to joke, but then he said, guys, are we ready? Okay, it's fully booked for lunch. We've got a VIP guest coming. And today we've learned the Ngoi Mio is on the way to the place. Big pressure. He said, okay, so everybody's ready. Everybody's, and you have to. And because you're only as good as your team, you know. So that's what I call tough. And also, if you want to learn, you have to redo it and do it and do it until it's perfect. Yeah. Although perfection doesn't exist. I mean, the closest you come to perfection.
Yeah.
And that's what for me is tough. Bullying. I mean, yes, unfortunately, some of the chefs lose it sometime or did in the past and for different reasons. But generally tough because they've got a reputation to keep, mainly, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of, especially at that level in terms of, you know, 3 stars to get there in the first place. The work to get there is incredible, but the work to maintain is also incredible, right? I mean, and so you kind of get. I think that the key thing is we're all human, and everybody can have the moments where they just lose their mind for a moment, you know, and that happens. But it's what happens next that's the most important thing.
Yes.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And I definitely don't think that we should be jumping down the throats of people in individual moments. If there's a consistency of problem, then that's the point where there's some re-education that needs to happen.
But, yes, that's very difficult.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mentioned pressure in Swiss Michelin star, but you can also say that this pressure in every single restaurant. Mm. If a pizzeria is the top in his game for making the best pizza, there is pressure for him to carry on and be consistent. Consistency doesn't go only for 3-star. It goes for any places, from a bistro to an auberge to a Trattoria to et cetera, et cetera. In every environment, if they're standard and you've got a great reputation, without rating, it doesn't matter because rating, it's what people think about your place. Rating is your customer, basically.
Yeah.
It is not the rest. Yes, you've got 3-star, great. But if your restaurant is empty, it doesn't matter, yeah? So your customer are your rating, basically. Yep. You know, we're not talking social media now, which has been completely invading the scene, and everybody suddenly is an expert in food tasting and wine, and you know, suddenly the criticism goes for people who never even touch anything. But anyway,
That's probably a podcast all on its own. That one, But so what happened next then after your experience in inverted commas?
Well, I went back again. So I went back again to where I was in the Hotel Beau Site in Luxeuil-les-Bains. I went back again as a head chef this time.
Right.
Put back in practicing. And I love this place. And I got on very well with the owner. And I remember one day he told me that I was his spiritual son. So it was very touching.
That's very cool.
And, very beautiful place. And he even one day asked me to take over the place. And I said, no, I was a bit too young. I thought I was, I had a very good level, good standard and everything. And, we always stay friends all the time with the family. He passed away quite a long time ago. His wife's still alive. She's remarried, but, still in my heart, still a beautiful place where I learned one of the best time of my life as an apprentice. My learning was complete in a sense, and we used to do from charcuterie to butchery to deboning fish to all the stock. So a complete kind of thing from dessert, pastry, chocolate, etc. So when there was a head chef, I ran the place with him very well, everything, until he asked me to take over. And I said, no, I want to still carry on and learn more and everything. And I applied for my first position of head chef ever. And I end up in Scotland in Nockingham Lodge Hotel in Port Patrick, which is a beautiful hunting lodge, which was my first genuine head chef position outside where I used to be an apprentice, you know.
Yeah.
Because actually, I was working as a head chef under him, so I was literally a sous chef, really, but it doesn't matter.
How do you go from that to Scotland? Like, how does that even come about?
Well, it's a strange thing. Originally, when I was a little bit younger than that, so I was 27 at that time. I won a competition, regional competition, when I was in Luxembourg, and I ended up doing representing my region with the produce of my region in Sweden with the help of the tourism office and SAS, Scandinavian Airline System Airline. And I used to go in Lund, Malmö, and Gothenburg and talk about Franche-Comté and bring the produce and do guest chef at a young age. It was very nerve-wracking. And I loved it and everything. So originally, I wanted to live in Sweden after all my training and everything before I end up in Scotland, actually. And by default, because it was not too much after the Kosovo War and all Yugoslav, everything, and they had already too many foreign people going in Sweden because they accepted a lot of Yugoslav from that conflict. And I was about two to three months too late to apply for a visa. So it was refused because they closed the door. So by default, I ended up in Scotland, really. And so I had my meeting in Paris with the cousin of that person who owned Nokinam. And we were selected there and he flew me over and we had a meeting there. And that was it. He took me as a head chef. We got on very well straight away. And the student child, a young couple, originally from the Seychelles, he was. And that's it. That was my first head chef position at 27 right. years of age, which now people are head chef at 19. So imagine what kind of knowledge, what kind of knowledge have you got? But there you go. So, and that's it. And that's where I got my first Michelin star, which was, wow, amazing.
Right, right, right. Was that, were you pursuing it? Were you pursuing the star or were you just doing the food that you wanted to do?
And we were doing the best food possible, what we want out of all Scottish produce and season. We had a small garden too. We use all the best produce from around. Yeah, I'm still friends with my ex-suppliers of Nokinam, which now own a beautiful farm called Sandbribe above Glasgow, which supply Sadband and Claude Bossy and all these guys on top poultry, duck and chicken. And it's fantastic. Yeah. Why memory? Nokinam was amazing. We were only 6 Michelin star in Scotland at the time and 18 in England. That's all.
Right.
That's all. So it was pretty, to get a Michelin star in the 80s, it was very difficult. And I was, wow, proud.
Yeah.
Really proud.
But yeah. I love the fact that that's been a byproduct of you just doing what makes sense for one where you are, but also the produce you have access to and all of that. And it's almost like you're doing that from your heart. And so the accolades just come because of that. It's not because you're pushing because we need to hit this standard, you know, in order to achieve this star. Yes, we're going to be pushing to hit a standard because that is the place in which we work. But but at the same time, it's almost like the food is coming from the heart and the soul rather than with accolades in mind.
Yes, and it should be that way.
Yeah.
You don't cook for the star. You don't cook for the rating. You cook because originally you become a chef because you've seen your parents entertaining and cooking for their friend and family. And cooking, that's what it is, to cook for your friend, family, your guests.
Yeah.
You cook with everything you've got, the best you can. And people can feel it in a place. You don't cook for Michelin. I see too many. I mean, if you look at a lot of the 2-star in UK, for example, I take 2-star, not 1-star, but okay, whatever, 1, 2. And you look at what they're doing, everybody's doing the same than the other one. So now the fashion of all have 3 dishes to serve on a table, 1 on a rock, 1 on a skewer, 1 on this. Everybody's doing it. The plate is done by an artisan. We suddenly become all sustainable. I mean, you look at that and say, okay, guys, cook what you want to cook, the way you want to cook, with the best produce you can, which means when it's represented in a plate, it'll be a fantastic dish. You don't need to, I don't have that stone to put my canapé on it. What should I do? I mean, wow, okay, great. They got the buying power. They got a lot of beautiful stuff on the thing, but you're cooking for the star when you do that.
Yeah.
You're cooking to impress. Oh, he's got 2-star because he's doing that. So if I do the same, I'll have 2-star. No, it's not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean by that.
And
I
didn't say
that, mention any name, nothing. It's not the point. The point is the way sometimes the misunderstanding of what you should do. And, yes, we could have had 2-star and 3-star. It's no problem at all. The point is not there. I want to cook the way I feel, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what keeps the smile on your face, Daniel, all this time.
Now to cook with the season. I'm excited about the season. I mean, there's an orchard in here, which is nearly half a mile long, which is actually on our private, on a private road of a small thing. So nobody had, there's plum, there's pear, there's apple, there's Victoria plum, there's, everything. I went yesterday, collect everything. It's in the kitchen there. And I'm excited. I'm going to do a plum tart probably tomorrow. I've got fresh apple, eating apple. There's the one for doing stewed apple. I'm not quite ready. I go every day and march and pick up and eat half a kilo from the tree. If people want to see me, I'm in the tree eating, you know. I mean, it's beautiful. That's why we... And this year is a bumper year because it's been so hot. Mm. I mean, the tree can't even cope with the weight of the fruit. It's everything is just like... but that's what I love.
Yeah.
And it's a mushroom season. I haven't yet been mushroom picking. I don't know what I've done yet. I need to.
All in good time. But so Scotland, how long were you there for?
7 years.
7 years. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So that is a significant portion of your career.
Loved
there.
It. I loved it to the point that I tried to buy an Okinam when it was for sale and I couldn't afford it.
Right.
And it was even too much for me to try to borrow money. Not that I could not, but I said, oh my God. Have that on your shoulder. But we had the clientele, we had this and that. And I said, okay, we have 10 bedrooms. I said, is 10 bedrooms enough to be able to, you know? And I think I possibly got scared a little bit as well to take that on.
It's a big burden, you know, financially.
I know, but I mean, it was, you know, for 750 grand at the time.
Right. Beautiful hunting lodge.
I love Nokinam. I still love it. Beautiful hunting lodge surrounded by 3 creeks on the sea. Stunning.
Nice.
Gorgeous. Near Port Patrick. Wow. Dumfries and Galloway. I love it.
Right. Sold. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So what happened next? Where did you head after that?
So from there, I've stayed from 86 to 92. Yeah. So 7 seasons. After that, I went to Singapore. I've had an opportunity. I met somebody who was the next Michelin inspector. His name was Chris Watson. And he was a Michelin inspector who did inspect me when I was in Nokinam. And we met again for some reason, and he just took a job working for a Singapore lady who owned and just done a small boutique hotel out of 7 shop houses in Duxton Hill in Singapore. The place was running. He became a general manager. Contacted me after the executive chef left, and he said, Daniel, there's a position there, beautiful boutique hotel, and we're looking for a chef. Would you like to take that on board? So I was headhunted to do that, and I said, yes, okay. And so... There, off I go, Singapore, and the Duxton Hotel become Relais Chateau, the only Relais Chateau in Southeast Asia at the time. We were a direct competitor with the Raffles, one of the best restaurants in Singapore, and I stayed there 3.5 years because it's every 2 years renewable, and the reason I've done only 1.5 after it's because my dad passed away, so I decided to go back to Europe.
Right.
It was a great, great experience. I absolutely loved it. Singapore was amazing. So much opportunity there. I could have stayed in Southeast Asia and lived there, or from there going to Japan. Yes, for sure. But my dad passed away, and I said, okay, I need to be close to maman, like we do. All boys are the same with maman. So I went from there 1 year in Portugal to run Mary Jean Penina in Algarve, in the south of Portugal, and very challenging. I never done a big hotel before. We had 8 outlets. And my duty was to make all new menu for all the outlets. I had a 1-year contract. So I've done that with difficulty in a sense. And it was difficult because I learned the language within a few months, or a little bit more. I had to because most of my executive chef was Portuguese. Some of the chef was Portuguese. So I had to bring a small team of English and French speaking guys to help me for different outlets, which was not easy. But very good experience. I really enjoyed it. The general manager was an amazing guy, very strict, very severe, but he had a big job as well to run a place like that. So, yeah, so 1 year. And after that, came back to UK. I was given the opportunity to run Harvey's in Bristol, the famous Harvey's restaurant. And I took it, and I stayed there for 7 years. And... get a star, and nearly had 2 stars before the owner, Alain Domecq, decided to sell the place. And that was my biggest regret. It's like somebody cutting the grass under your feet. And I was lined up for the 2nd star that year, and they sold the brand to Pernod Ricard and the wine to Fortuna America, and he said the restaurant has to go, but I said I want to buy it because we've got a really good team, we're doing very well. I had the same 8 staff for 7 years. No movement in my team, nothing.
Wow.
It was amazing, yeah. Amazing team. And everybody was gutted. And I said, I want to buy the restaurant. I said, well, the restaurant is Harvey, it's part of the brand, you can't. We need to, and it's still closed nowadays in Bristol. Denmark Street behind the Hippodrome is still closed, yeah, everything.
What a shame, yeah.
So that was very difficult because I knew we were going to have 2 stars. I knew it. There you go.
Yeah.
Very disappointing.
Yes.
So from there, go to L'Ortolan, where was John Burton Race, you remember?
Yeah.
And that's the same, L'Ortolan. I ran it for 1 year with all my team from Harvey's because we came all out. We said, okay, if we're going to get 2 stars there, we will get them in L'Ortolan. And L'Ortolan had already a pass with 2 stars 2 or 3 times. In that Christmas, we received a bonus plus a letter telling us and the owner is selling the place.
Oh, great. Another one.
Okay. So my boss from Nokidam came and he said, okay, Daniel, I'll buy it for you. And with you. And we came, sit down, and the owner said, oh, by the way, the freehold is not anymore for sale. It's only a leasehold. So we said, no, we're not interested.
Right.
And from there, I went to Clifden, which I was headhunted from there. Ah. And I ran Clifden for 7 years. And we still, to this date, have be the last team to have a Michelin star in Clifden.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Good. And your lengths of service in places are very good. Like, you know, from you're 3.5 years, 7 years, 7 years, another seven years.
Yeah. And after the vineyard, 7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I stopped the vineyard in 2016.
Was it 7 years at the vineyard as well?
Yeah.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is actually when you came onto my radar, because I was a bit of a late developer into the UK food scene, having started the first part of my career on cruise ships, which is basically like being on the moon.
Of course, yeah, which is tough too.
Yeah. But we weren't really aware of who was doing what in the UK food scene because we were just focused on our own little world. And so when I first came to the UK, I got my head into who was doing what and all of that. And you were at the time, you'd just taken over from John Campbell, I think.
Oh, yes, correct,
at the Vineyard. Yeah, and so that was the first time that I saw you on TV. As well, around
that's right.
Time. Yeah. Was that the first time that you'd done TV work?
No, I started when I was in Clifden.
Okay.
James Winter, who was a co-producer of Saturday Kitchen on BBC, came to dine, and I think James came as well, it could be. And they said, oh, would you like to do Saturday Kitchen? Yeah, because they came to dine at the Waldorf. We had a Michelin star there. Like I said, we to this date, we are the last one to have the star at Clifden. Mm. And I said, yes, and that's where I started TV. For a little bit, I'm not a host on television. I do appearance.
Yeah. But nevertheless, when TV comes calling, I would imagine it's a tricky one to not turn down because it could bring so much to you as a chef, I would imagine, in terms of raising your own profile.
Definitely, it's very interesting. It's interesting because although even if you get chef, as long as you regulate, it's nice. If you do a book, it helps to sell the book and to put you out there. And people, you don't never know who watched the program. And obviously, I had 4 times 1 Michelin star. So it's quite, I'm one of the few in UK to have 4 times 1 Michelin star.
Yeah.
The guy who's done more than that is Sean Hill, who'd have 5 times 1 star, you know?
Right.
So it's quite important because it shows a lot of consistency.
Yeah.
But of course, I need to thank my team. I have to thank all my guys, and I never take anything for granted. It's not the point. So that shows a good consistency along quite a lot of years. So that's very important.
No doubt. And actually, the way you put it is way better than I put it. I said very, very long time. You said quite a lot of years. Yours is is a softer way of putting it for sure. But let's finish your story first because you've taken us up to the vineyard. Bring us home up to now in terms of how you got to where you're doing and what you're doing now.
So, but first, so I stopped in 2016 because family reason as well, and very, very tired, and because my wife got stage 4 cancer, that stage 3 became stage 4, sorry, and I was very tired, so I took the Gore Hotel as a consulting, so that means I could have a lot of time at home as well, so that lasted until March 2020, which it was just perfect. It's finished a week of COVID. That was the end of my contract. Boom.
Right.
But she passed away in December 2022. Yeah, so that was one of the main reasons, but also because I was starting to be tired. Anyway, so and after that, I started a little bit, I still done a little bit of television, but I started to cook at home, Daniel Country Kitchen, which now is called Daniel Galmiche French Kitchen. I've got a new partner. She's absolutely wonderful. Her name is Elise. And she's also doing my social media with me. And I feel sometimes I've been blessed twice.
And
yeah, she's completely charming, adorable, and just love this woman. And so it's good. That's why I keep a smile on my face too.
Very good.
I feel I'm a lucky man twice. And and we're doing a lot of things together. We get on very well, and we do a lot of short reel and going. We try to not get invited. It's not the point to go to places and make sure we do a proper reel and talk about thing, and we make things moving with, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of the Instagram.
I have, yes.
So it's all good. I'm doing a lot of guest chef, which I love doing. And that also, again, my Michelin star serves me well, you know, because a lot of people still, because of your Michelin star, want to do things with you. And that, you never lose it. When you've been Michelin star, you're always a Michelin star, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because consistency is a sign of standard, of discipline, and people love it.
Do you know what? I think it was Daniel Clifford that said to me that, and I'd never thought about this until he said this, but it makes so much sense, is that basically as a chef, if you continue to learn and you continue to keep pushing forward, is that you can never really become a worse chef. You're only going to get better. So even if you have a section away from, you know, running a kitchen or whatever, you don't forget the classics, the base learning that, you know, all that time that you spent, as an example, you're learning sauce all the way back. You don't forget how to do that stuff. It never leaves you, right? It's like riding a bike, you know. And so actually, then, as you say, when you then get the opportunity to do these other things here, there, and everywhere, people are intrigued because one, you, as I said at the top of the show, you've been around the industry at the front end for a long time, and I'll ask you a question around that in a second. But also, it's not like you were just moving from one place to the next. You did longevity in each place. You probably took a lot of learning from each place and moved forward as well.
Of course.
But whilst also maintaining this really high standard. And to be able to do that over a long period of time, it's no mean feat. And, you know, I think especially then to do it with a smile on your face. And this is the thing that for me, I love more than anything else. Is just the way that you wrapped up your journey there was actually... You know, you're doing something completely different now.
Absolutely.
You know, but that's the joy of it, right? Is that you've adapted, you've evolved into what the world needs from you as Daniel Galmiche, the Michelin starred chef.
I think it's a different journey. It's a very interesting journey. It's very different. But sometimes it's not the job is up and down. Yes, a little bit. Sometimes you say, oh, okay, I need to have a bit more of this, a bit more of that. And that's why you realize in the climate at the moment can be a bit tricky. So you need to keep your, different basket and make sure you've got a bit of diversity as well. But generally speaking, yes, I'm always in contact with people, always doing things. And like I said, I love doing guest chef. I've got a big guest chef in September going to Bulgaria. That's my third time I go there. It's a beautiful boutique restaurant called Ten Dieci, who means 10 actually in Italian. He's a wonderful guy, very talented, do kind of modern cooking, you know, very eclectic, very kind of advanced technology and everything. But also, he's the only 100% sustainable restaurant in all Eastern Europe. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I admire the guy and he's passionate about it. I mean, it's called Dieci, like I said, number 10, because he does 10 covers, 10 courses per night. Done. People arrive at 6:30, 7 they're sitting for aperitif and canapé, 11 o'clock they're gone. In between, intermezzo in Italiano, si, non è parlare. Everybody stop, we go around a big, big fire, 12 chairs, that's mean 10 chairs for the guest, and two, one for him, one for me. We muddle with the guests, we talk about different subject life, what they're doing, how come they come to Dieci. Some of them, recently, he had the head sommelier of 11 Madison, New York, flying from New York, meeting some people publishing you in Bulgaria, and came to his restaurant. I mean, that's the way sometimes small jewel like that can bring people. We get on super well. We've got the same discipline. And the reason he does have the same discipline is not originally from the trade. He's the next captain of the Black Hawk American Army. He's not any kind of,
right,
you know, the guy who served in Afghanistan, yes, Iraq, Iran, and all these places. And when you're talking Black Hawk, it's like the SAS. Huh?
He's yes, he is the very walking epitome of discipline.
Absolutely. Captain of Black Hawk, you need to be. So his discipline is amazing, but also his talent. He speaks 7 fluent languages. We do the service in Italian always. It's quite funny. And he's fanatic about sustainability. We only use Bulgarian produce, 100%. So I have to put my head on. What is the season in Bulgaria? What do we have every day? The menu is sent to me. I do my 5 course. He does his 5 course. And I love the guy. He's straightforward. He's a Trump supporter. Doesn't matter. He's straight, neat. That's it. Boom. But fantastic guy. And his wife, Anna, does all the front. They're only 2 cooking. He cooks 10 courses every night. And his wife serves 10 people every night with all the wine matching. 2 in 2. That's all. It's a home in the same time. Gone.
Yeah, nice.
He works every night. They don't work for lunch. Every night. And he has 2 guest chefs per year, and I'm always one of them. We fully book. I'm going for 8 days. We're visiting a vineyard. We're visiting a Wayu farm, which is one of the best in all Eastern Europe, with some of the cattle directly coming from Japan. I mean, it's amazing how rich is Bulgaria. 70% of forest, mushroom everywhere, people cultivating back garden because, obviously, if you look from here right side, it's all on the back of Greece. So the climate is perfect for vineyards and everything. Mm. Anyway, so that's one of the guest chefs I love doing. And I'm looking forward to it in 4 weeks' time.
You know, that wasn't coming across, Daniel, that you were excited about doing that. The passion that you've just shown for that. That sounds amazing, though. Sounds amazing. And also kind of just showcases the point that I said earlier on in our chat around the diversity of things that you can get up to as a chef.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So small consulting or like we do with Elise on social media, and we're having loads of fun together. And she works very hard because it's very tricky what she does. She had to edit the way she edit. If you look at a picture, she can make it come alive within the picture. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
She's super talented.
Yeah. So as I kind of alluded to, you know, you've been at the forefront for a while now, a couple of years, as we've discussed. What's your secret? How do you maintain this longevity in a career and still have this verve and excitement and smile and you know, and everything that you've
got? I love it. I mean, I've done a golf day the other day with Sturia caviar, the French caviar. And Goldstone, Black Eastern was there, and he asked the same question.
Of course he was.
He looked at me, he thought I was 55, and when I told him I was 67, he said, "What the?" He said, "Sorry, impossible." He said, "You look like, wow." I said, "Well, I am." "Sorry, I'm born in 58. I said, "Make the calculator, I'm 67. And he said, "Well, good on you. I said, "I tell you, I don't know your secret, but he said, "Good on you." I said, "I'm a happy guy." I said, "This is my secret. And I love what I do."
There's a lot to be said for being happy, right?
No, I think, it's easy to be grumpy. Yes, we all have days we have been sometimes down and grumpy and this and that. But overall, when you see what's going on everywhere, you realize how lucky we are, if you know what I mean. Absolutely, big time. We never forget that.
Yeah.
Well, for sure. And I say that to my son, and we say that to Ellie's sons, and
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, there's just one more thing I want to ask you before I let you get on with your day. Because I had no idea, actually, that your journey had taken in so many different places around your career, and still continues to do so with your Bulgarian adventure coming up. But what's been your best adventure so far? Where have you really just felt, do you know what, this place is incredible and I love being here?
I mean, I think there's 4 altogether, I would say. So my apprenticeship, for sure, was amazing. I get on very well. I learned so much. It was a pleasure. It was a great team. It was the 70s where you can have a lot of fun. And Europe in the 70s was very opulent and very open and very, not extravagant, but beautiful. After that, probably the Gavroche as well, definitely. I think this is one of my best working, learning, apart from my apprenticeship. I mean, it was intense, but
Set the tone for everything.
Set the tone for what's follow. But my apprenticeship was important for me to be able to do that. I was very young. If I didn't have a complete apprenticeship, I wouldn't have held it in a garage. And I became, because of what knowledge I had from that, I became the youngest chef de partie. I was promoted after 3 months to first commis, and after that, chef de partie. I was the youngest chef de partie in a garage at the time, by far.
Right.
And that was, even myself, I was surprised. After that, Nokinam, probably. All of them, but the four is apprenticeship, Gavroche, Nokinam, because it's my first Michelin star. I became chef of the year in Scotland. We had nearly the maximum on AA, including AA inspector, who said to me, I never, ever tasted sauces like you make. He was raving about my sauces. He made a great article about it. And after that, probably Harvey's in Bristol. I loved Harvey's. I knew we were doing well, and I think we could have possibly had 3 stars there. We were in this kind of a bubble environment where the team made it, not only me, my 8 guys, including me, were just gelling. It is like if we were all brothers, team, right team, for doing the right thing, all exchanging ideas, all making try, all beautiful, strict during the service, because we all knew what we had to do. Nobody walked on boundaries. And we knew, like I said, the year, and I don't exhaust it, we were lined up for 2 stars. And from there on, we knew what we could do, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So that's also one of my biggest regrets, the way sometimes big company, like some of them who got backers and they pulled the plug and suddenly you're down. Like, example, Eric Chavot, when he was doing so well with his brasserie, and suddenly the owner of the building decided to put the rate so high.
Yeah, what can you do?
Then Eric said, you know what, guys? Pack up everything. We're locking the door. I'm going. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, he's a super talented guy. Eric is a good friend of mine. We speak basically every 2 weeks together. So that's possibly one of my biggest regrets. But overall, I always love what I do. I think I always love the trade. And finally, to talk about that, I had so many arguments with my dad. Because when I wanted to join the trade, although he was a gourmand, although he loved cooking, he wanted me to be like his father. His father was a surgeon in Salpêtrière in Paris. And he wanted one of his sons to follow and to do medicine. And for a few years, he didn't speak too much to me because of that. Until one day, knock, knock, knock at the door in Nokinam, or in my home. And this is my dad coming and realizing that what I chose was the right thing and congratulate me on receiving a Michelin star. So that was a moment which was not only a surprise, was very, not humbling, it was kind of, I don't know how to describe that, when he came and realized that it's like an apology for him without being an apology and recognized. And he said, okay, can you take me on a golf course and teach me how to play golf?
can you take me into the kitchen and teach me how to make a sauce?
But also, Phil, it's after that, I didn't see him too much. I went to Singapore and he died when I was in Singapore. And I realized then, I really didn't know my dad very well, if you know what I mean. My dad was 57, I was 30-something. I said, I don't know my dad. But I remember when he came at the door and realized, my son, you choose your trade well. Congratulations on your star, you know, and give me a cuddle. And so it's kind of
It's almost like a rites of passage. It also shows that parents don't always know, although... You know, that's not maybe a great message to send to the world, but you know, the thing is that you followed your heart, right? You followed the thing that has really made you come alive, and often when people do that, good things happen because you're doing the thing that you're supposed to be doing, and you're not forcing something.
Yeah, I think so, and I was, and actually, it's funny because I was good in science, I could have done medicine. I love medicine. Actually, it's in my genetic. I can't think. I'm interested in it.
Yeah.
And I love it, but it's not what I want to do. I want to use my hand. I want to touch and smell. And
If you've learned butchery, you've kind of become a surgeon anyway, right?
But that's why the trade is beautiful. And that's why we need to really, like you said, rightly at the beginning, try to make sure that people join the trade. It is beautiful and they need to realize that there's so much to learn. Not only languages, not only making friends, not only traveling, not only different kind of cooking, but it's an environment where you can do so much. You can live, you can grow, you can explode, you can this and that. And it's been tough in the past, the image of the trade, because of some people who have a little bit made that kind of a bad image. And but my regret, I've got one regret in a trade, that with everything I've done in UK, for example, as far as I went with a lot of people, because if I speak to all my peers, sometimes I don't realize how many people really respect me. I don't realize how much book I've sent, how many people got my book and everything. But only once finalist of the Chef of the Year award for the KT. But sometimes I feel then, without looking for it, whatever, I feel I should have had at least something within a trade. Not only the star, not the thing, whatever, which is very important, but kind of what I've done, the number of people I teach, the number of people who have done things, whatever. And but I never ask for it. I never go to gala dinner. I never go to the French embassy. I never go to these places, because that's not what I am. But sometimes I feel then that is possibly missing a little bit.
Well, there's time yet, young man. There's time yet.
Absolutely. But you know what I mean by that? Without the...
Totally. Especially, but I think here's the thing, that, and this has been a message, I think, all the way through your journey, certainly from what I've picked up, is that you're an absolute case in point as to just do the thing. It's that old cliche around, you know, figure out the thing that you love doing the most and then you'll never have to work a day in your life. Now, I'm sure there are days where it's felt like you've had to work a day in your life.
I don't know that one unless I become a millionaire on a lottery.
Indeed. But I think, you know, you picked a trade that speaks to you, gets the best out of you, allows you to learn, takes you places, has given you a lot of things. But you're also doing it because you want to, rather than because you have to do it because of I expect X, Y, Z at the end of it. And that's way more powerful, I think.
Yeah. And I think that I was talking about my dad earlier, and I said I didn't know him well enough. It's true. But also what perhaps did set me, and I used to go a lot in nature with my dad when I was young, because he was not only a hunter, but a lover of nature. So we used to go in forest quite often. We used to go hunting, so we used to push the game towards the hunters. He used to own a hunt in a Vosges and Alsace, and we used to go there and everything. And he showed me how to recognize mushroom, how to pick mushroom, to recognize different kind of tree and what they do and all that. So I think he did, without my knowledge at that time, set me on the path as well, because I love nature. I love walking forest. I love to go mushroom picking. I love to do this kind of stuff. And in that sense, he did set me up. And after that, he shouldn't be surprised if I decide I want to be a chef. And he said, well, why would you do that? Working hours to get nothing. You're crazy. No. I would like you to. But he knew secretly what I was doing.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Superb. Yeah. Well, look, Daniel, thank you so much for your time. Please don't ever change. Every single time I've come into contact with you, you've always made me feel just a little bit better about the world. We need more people like you doing what they love, putting smiles on people's faces, and then we'd be in a pretty damn good place, I think, as an industry.
That's what we do, is it? We cooking, we invite, we make people feel good, even with a simple roasted pork chop with a mushroom sauce, isn't it?
Well, if it's a sauce made by you, I'm there.
As long as the pork is on good quality and organically and everything,
Yeah. Superb. Well, enjoy Bulgaria, and I look forward to bumping into you somewhere else.
Wow. Do you know, talking briefly about Bulgaria to finish, not only the guy's got the green key for being one of the top sustainable restaurants in all Europe, there's only 12 in France, one in UK, and one in Bulgaria for the whole Eastern Europe. But also when he wrote to SRA, Sustainable Restaurant Association, and they said to him, give me all the detail of what you do, everything, and we see if you can get the top award. Within a week, they answer him. They said, we never seen anybody in the whole of SRA award have 98% of what you have.
Wow.
And they gave him the SRA top rating within a week.
Wow.
And unbelievable, to the point, and he recycled plastic, he make a brick with his plastic, and he built a small place next to him, all made with the recycled brick plastic.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, very cool. Yeah, and visionary as well, right? I love this. We need visionaries everywhere to be able to innovate us forward.
Yes, and that point, some people think that they are sustainable because they got a green star. Yeah. I mean, compared to what of these guys, they're doing nothing.
Yeah.
Yes. Different kind of bean, a little bit of compost. My food comes from the garden and this and that. That's all. And you got a green key. This guy should have 3 green key. It tells you the difference of what people think about sustainability.
Yeah.
We need to do more, certainly.
Yeah. But, well, anyway, I completely agree. And yeah, God, I can talk to you all day and probably will.
Me too. But,
nice one. Thanks so much, Daniel. Well, have a great rest.
You're very, very welcome. Much appreciate take the time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
Very kind. And take we care. Hope we see one day each other, yeah?
I'm sure we will.
Soon.
Indeed. We always bump into each other at random stuff. So
yes, we do.
Yeah,
we do.
Indeed.
Yes.
Good man.
If you go to a National Chef of the Year, I'll be there judging you.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Well, there we are then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see each other there, October.
Fantastic. Thank nice you. One. Take care, Daniel.
So much.
Cheers.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye. Well, I can't tell you how much of a joy it was to spend some time with Daniel. His passion for food, nature, and the people shines through in everything he does. Few chefs can look back on such a rich career across so many kitchens and countries and still speak with the same humility, humour, and love for the craft as he does. What really stood out for me was Daniel's belief that food is never about chasing stars, but about cooking from the heart, respecting the seasons, and always valuing your team around you. Those lessons are timeless and a true reminder of why hospitality is such a special industry. We'll of course be back with another cracking conversation soon, so until then, look after yourselves, and we'll catch you again the next time.